Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hi, guys. This is another Tax Tuesday. This is Toby Mathis and
Jeff Webb.
All right. So we're just going to dive right in. We have a lot to go through. There always seems to be more than we can actually seem to hit in one show. So it's a good problem to have, I guess, because it means there's lots of people asking questions. All right. So let's just dive right on in. I do go over most, like just about anything I can get, unless you write me a book. I'm going to try to knock out your question. If you do write me a book, we're going to say email it in. And if you're platinum, we'll answer it. If you're not platinum, then we'll have somebody contact you to see what it would take to become so we can give you very detailed, fact-specific responses. This is supposed to be fun. You're supposed to be looking at taxes as something that's enjoyable because it's a very rewarding subject. If you learn how to handle your taxes, you can put a lot of money in your pocket. And folks that really understand tax, including whether you like them or not, our president happens to be very good at understanding tax and has used the tax laws to his advantage, probably to the point where he doesn't want you to see his tax return, because most people would say, how the heck did you do that? That's not fair. But anyway, we won't get into all that fun stuff. It is what it is. The tax laws are written. I take no stance on them other than we're going to take advantage of the ones we can and use them to the best advantages we can. So it should be kind of fun. It's like a Rubik's Cube. So unless you hate Rubik's Cubes. Opening questions. We have a whole bunch to go through. So property aggregation, what is it and why would I want to do it? Next question is, what happens if I forget to file a form 8606, which has to do with a non-deductible contribution to a retirement plan, aka a Roth? Is there any other one that you'd be doing?
No, you can make non-deductibles through traditional.
That's right. You can do non-deductible, but then, all right. Is acting as a partnership representative a prohibited transaction? That's up with some of the new tax laws. What principal address should I use for my LLC if I work from home? Can paying my minor kids for their work in my business offset taxes? Do I have to file returns in each state where I own rental property? That's always interesting. And then, of course, you guys can ask questions live. Let's dive into these ones first. Property aggregation. What is it and why would I do it? Do you want to knock this one out?
Property aggregation, this has to do with the participation rules, material participation and active participation. Same basically that you have enough hours. The material participation rule says, the primary one says you have to have 750 hours in an activity.
Material participation or the real estate professional? Material, I think it's 500, not to mince words, but.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. So you always have two things. You have, hey, I'm a real estate professional and I'm going to, you actually have to meet both the material participation and real estate professional, the 750 hour, with it being more than 50% of your use of your working time.
Right.
You have to meet all those. And it's per property unless you make an aggregation election.
Or as I say, per activity.
Per activity. Yep, that's a good way to put it. So if you're going to be real estate professional, since we deal with a lot of real estate investors, you have to make a property aggregation election. Otherwise, you literally, like there's actually a court case on this where mm-hmm. you'd have to qualify and spend the time on each property. Now, the court case screwed it up because they did 750 hours on one property. And I think it's actually 500, but neither way, what you look at is you have to meet the time test. And if you don't want to do it per property, you make an election to treat them all as one activity.
And the whole idea behind this is to convert it from passive income to non-passive income.
Mm-hmm.
The one problem you may run into is if you have a bunch of passive losses built up
mm-hmm.
and then you aggregate the property. Normally, when you sell a property, you release all the losses from that property.
Mm-hmm.
Once you aggregate all your properties, you can't release any of those losses until you sell everything, all the properties.
Right. It's all one activity. So it's one property as far right. as the IRS is concerned. All right. So why is it? Why would I want to do it? If you're a real estate professional, you could write off the passive losses against your active income because it's no longer passive. It's deemed passive unless you meet the exception, which is real estate professional status. So when does somebody use it? You use it when you're a real estate professional. It's right. really what it boils down to.
And can have a substantial effect on the income.
Yep. What happens if you forget to file form 8606? The IRS beats you with a stick. No, actually, there is no penalty. Like, they let you kind of go back whenever In fact, you don't even have to file a tax return. We were looking at this about an hour ago, kind of digging into it, going, Jeff and I were kind of like, hey, maybe we have to file a return. And no, you don't have to file a return. You don't have to do anything. As long as you're letting them know. And all we're doing is saying, hey, I made a non-deductible contribution. The idea is you're letting them know that there's something in there that you put in that you were not taking a tax deduction for.
Right. The one other time you use this form is if you change a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. That also runs through this 8606.
So when you took a traditional...
Because you have to recognize the income.
Right. You recognize. All right. So
when you convert it.
But they're letting you go back. So like, again, there was this, hey, what happens if you don't? The IRS really isn't doing it. They're glad you're filing it. You could lump them up. I'll tell you what, this is one of those plugs of why you use a tax professional, because the software will trigger this thing and create it for you. Most people have no idea that this form even exists. In fact, there's a bunch of folks asking, what the heck is it? If you make a contribution to a Roth, you're letting them know, by the way, I put money into this thing.
Yep.
And now they know. And that way, when you take that money back out, it offsets that amount. They know that you can always take that money out anytime you want. Like, there's no 5-year test. There's no waiting until you're 70 and a half. You can just take the money back out. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah. And this form's important. If you've done a backdoor IRA, backdoor Roth IRA, where you're making too much money to make the Roth contribution, you got to file this form to get that basis in that Roth IRA.
Yeah. And so the backdoor IRA, I've always thought of it as something else. So you're talking about, hey, I am phased out of being able to do a Roth IRA.
So I do a traditional contribution.
And then convert it.
And then convert it.
And there's no limitation on what you can convert. So you do that. And then, but again, that's interesting. All right. There you go. I always look at it as when you're dumping money into the solo.
Right.
And using that. But it sounds so sordid. We did the backdoor IRA. I don't know. There's just something wrong about that. Is acting as a partnership representative a prohibited transaction? Do you want to knock that?
No, this is all you.
No, push back. I'm going to throw this at Jeff. No, okay, so a partnership representative, there's new rules on what used to be a tax matters partner, which meant somebody who was responsible to deal with the IRS in the event they were auditing a partnership. Because for those of you who pay great attention to partnership taxation, partnerships don't pay tax. They pass the tax down to the owners. So if you have a partnership, which is two or more individuals or entities acting in concert for a business purpose, if you meet that test, you have to file a 1065 every year, which is an informational return. And what this says is, hey, we now have one party and we're going to assess the tax at the partnership level. So this is kind of weird. Now, certain people can opt out, but I can just tell you, none of our clients can because you're entities. You'd have to be individually owned, and quite often you look at that and it has to be less than 100 people, and they could say, hey, we're going to opt out of this and still use a tax matters partner. All this fancy way of saying is who the IRS deals with. Who's the party that they deal with? Now, this is why it's important. When I see prohibited transaction, I'm now thinking you're dealing with somebody who is investing through their IRA or 401k in a partnership.
Right.
And so let's say that you have two IRAs investing together in a transaction, or better yet, actually, the IRS uses an example of you have, company one and company two, and company two is an exempt organization, is an IRA or an LLC owned by an IRA or a 401k. You can just fill in the blank. That party doesn't pay tax on the receipt of the funds unless it's something called UBIT, but we're not going to worry about that. What they're saying is, hey, let's say that their owner's in a building. The reason it comes up is because when the partnership's being audited, you could say, hey, you shouldn't hit us that hard because part of us is owned by an exempt organization. Now, the party that is a participant in that exempt organization, so now we've gone through two different levels, okay? We have the partnership, we have the owner of the partnership, and now we have the participant in the owner of the partnership when that participant is an IRA or 401k. So we've broken it down into pieces. They are a prohibited, disqualified person as far as self-dealing with that or entering into transactions with that exempt organization, the IRA or the 401k, with very few exceptions. Are they a prohibited person from being a partnership representative? The answer is no, not as far as we can tell. There's nothing out there. In fact, if your IRA was audited, you're allowed to defend it. If your IRA is ripped off, you can start a lawsuit against the party who ripped you off and all those things. Like, you're allowed to do administrative activities on behalf of your IRA. So
you did really good on that one.
All right. That was a breakdown into little pieces. Lots of questions have been coming in. Is a partnership income in an IRA required income tax be paid on that income? I'm going to send you guys all to English school. And like, I'm just like reading some of these questions. I'm just teasing on you guys, but some of these are really bad. Does the IRA, no, the income flows through to the IRA and keeps its character. If it is unrelated business income, then you possibly could, if it's an act, you know, so if the IRA is getting active income, it's an active partner, then you might have an issue. But if it just owns like an interest in a corporation, interest in a passive activity, then we don't ever have to worry about that.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that IRA is going to get a K-1 from the partnership, but you just file it. There's nothing else to deal with it.
You are exempt for the most part. And then somebody says real estate professional. We've gone over real estate professional in the past, but I'll just tell you again. And like, I think I already said it once before, but I'm just going to go through it again very quickly. There are two pieces of real estate professional status. You have to, A, qualify as a real estate professional, which requires that you spend 750 hours and it is your number one use of your work time. So whichever one is greater. So you have to spend at least 750 hours and it has to be the greatest use of your business time. So if you spend 751 hours being a therapist, you lose. You're not a real estate professional. All right. If you meet that test, then you also have to be a material participant in your real estate activities. And that's a much lower test. That could be, you know, just a few hours up, but it's automatic if you spend over 500 hours and you have to aggregate all your activities into one. So our first question was about property aggregation. Right. That's about as much as I'm going to say. That converts a passive activity into where you can actually write it off against your ordinary income. Now, here's the big one. If you are filing a joint return with a spouse, only one spouse has to qualify and all activity is treated as one. Like, so you could be, you know, some executive somewhere making $1 million and your spouse spends enough of their time, his or her time on real estate, and they meet the test and it offsets your income because you have a bunch of losses. And material participation just means you're participating in any activity involving your property. It could be the managing, the manager, it could be looking for property, whatever. There's like a list. And there's a bunch of videos that I've done on those. And you can look at some of the past Tax Tuesdays as well. Now people are asking about opting out. If you don't opt out from the central audit regime, then are you required to pay tax at the partnership level? No, this is what it is they can assess the unpaid tax. They audit the partnership and the partnership is going to say the partnership now owes the tax. In other words, normally when they audited a partnership, they would just go and audit each of the partners. Now they don't have to do that anymore. They can just basically audit the partnership.
Yeah, these aren't all that different from the old TEFRA rules. It's you got companies and all kinds of stuff. You've got over 100 partners. Mm-hmm. We're just going to tax the partnership so you don't have to reissue K-1s to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, if you are a counselor consultant, do you need the same 750 hours? No, Leeds, you do not have to. This is only for real estate, and it's because real estate is deemed to be a passive activity unless you meet this exception. All right, we got lots of questions to hop through. What principal address should I use for my LLC if I work from home? It depends on where you set up your LLC. If you set up your LLC, generally speaking, you need to have a physical address. And I'm just going to say, for our purposes, when I work with LLCs, I use a physical address as the principal address, and it should be something different than your house. I don't like people showing up at folks' homes. I don't know how to put this.
Serving papers or?
Well, service of process is always one, but what you don't realize is that once you register a principal address for a business, everybody pulls that information and starts sending you stuff. So unless you love piles of paper, don't do it. And unless you want somebody showing up on your doorstep, door-to-dooring you for business services, don't do this. So what I would say, if you work from home, use a different principal address, use a physical address. You can have more than one address for a business. What you use with the state and for people that you don't know could be different than the one that you use for your main office, for example. You could have multiple offices. So you could have multiple principal places of business. I hope that makes sense. And, you know, last but not least is the good old fashioned P.O. box, too. Most states are going to require that you have a physical address, and then you could always have a P.O. box listed as well in different correspondences so that you don't have people, again, showing up at your house. I would just never use a home address, I guess, in anything that would be a public record, unless you really like people showing up at your house or just getting lots and lots of mail. Can paying my minor kids for their work in my business offset taxes? Absolutely.
Yeah.
They have to do something of value, but this is one of my favorite techniques. It's called income shifting. And you're shifting money that would have been in a higher bracket to somebody in a lower bracket. And if you know anything about me, you know I love that stuff. Somebody just asked on that last thing, but what about the IRS business address? It's whatever you use to file your SS4. And that one, I don't care whether it's your home, really.
Yeah, they don't particularly care as long as they have a place to contact you.
Yep, but it's not what you're putting out in the public. And just remember, as we've learned from our president, your tax returns are not a public record. People cannot just take them and say, give me your tax returns. They are private. You cannot go to the government and say, I want to see my neighbor's tax returns. You don't get to. Back to the kids. Speaking of governments, let's talk about children because they act that way. How can we pay kids? Is there a limit? You pay them either through your payroll. If you're a sole proprietor, you don't have to run through payroll. If you're anything else, you do. Partnership, you'd have to run through payroll too. But for the most part, I prefer to use corporations. You guys know me. I use accountable plans. There's way too many tax benefits not to do that, including if I'm employing my kids. So yes, you pay you employ your minor kids. There are cases on the books of companies paying 9-year-olds where the owner was the operator and they paid young children as long as the children can actually do the work. So someone said, can I pay my parents for babysitting?
That's a whole different.
Yeah, you're not going to be writing that off. That's not an expense. So yes, you could pay your parents, but that's not a benefit. Now, if you put your parents on your board of directors, and they did something and you paid them, that's much better because now you deduct it. They receive the income. And if they are in a lower tax bracket than you, i.e., what if they are below the threshold for tax? They have a standard deduction. Then it's fantastic. They pay zero taxes. We like that. Don't you like zero tax?
I love zero tax.
All right. Do I have to? I'm glad that I have a CPA standing next to me who says I love zero tax because some of the I get suspicious about CPAs sometimes as to who they actually work for. Because sometimes CPAs that I've met, it seems like they're going out of their way to make sure that their clients pay the most amount in tax as humanly possible. And you're like, what the heck are you doing? And they're like, oh, this is the way we have to do it. It's like, no. Do you have to file a tax return in each state where I own rental property?
My feelings on this is if you're making money in a state, you have to report that income somewhere. California in particular, I'm going to point that one out. We try to set up the LLCs and so forth that they're not actually operating in California.
Well, let's just talk about state income tax.
State income tax in general. Say I have a rental back in Kentucky and Ohio and Indiana. I'm going to have to pay taxes on those rentals. I'm doing business in those states. I have property in those states. I'm going to have to report something somewhere.
Do you have to do a separate tax return in each state?
Yeah, usually. If it's a partnership, when we talk about the pass-through entities, each state is different of whether you report or not.
Mm-hmm. I can say I have real estate in 10 different states. I do not file a state tax return in each state. I only file tax returns in the states that require that I file tax returns based off of like a franchise tax or things like that. Otherwise, you're going to pay tax where you receive the income as long as it's passive. You may have to. So there's always two things. This is fun to have an accountant because lawyers always say, oh, you have to file in this state and da, 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 da. And I said, there's two rules. There's the tax rule, which you don't have to register there to be subject to the tax. Ask the MyPillow guy whether he has a nexus to New York, because I know for a fact somebody got paid a lot of money for turning him in for not paying the sales tax.
Right.
Right. You can have a tax nexus with the state, but not be doing business in that state for purposes of having to register. Now, when you have real estate, it's real easy. Your business is there. Your entity is there. But if it is a flow-through entity and it's passive income, it's usually heading out of state. You may have a certain situation, for example, again, California, if you're just there, you're registered there, or even if a California resident individually owns something in another state, they consider that LLC doing business there for tax purposes, not for filing with the Secretary of State, but for paying tax. It is weird. You have different things. So So the answer would be it depends, unfortunately, on this one. Do I have to file returns in each state where I own rental property? It depends. And I would say as a general reason, unless Jeff wants to argue with me, the answer is no on rental properties, unless there's a law that requires that. But I mean, you're not paying income taxes in that state. You're going to pay income taxes in the state where you reside.
I think I'd go the other way. So if I have a rental property and Maryland's going to want their share of tax from that.
They have a franchise tax, but you can even be, I know Maryland because we have a bunch of properties there. You can even be exempt from that. So.
Well, then you have the weird ones like Tennessee where
then you
your
have a
entity
sponsor,
may
right.
have to pay a franchise tax, but you don't personally.
Right. So Tennessee is a great example. They have something called FONS, which is a family-owned non-corporate entity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Sometimes this stuff gets stuck in your head and you're like, get it out. But FONS just means, hey, if it's you owning it, then you don't have to pay tax there. Because they actually have two taxes. They have an excise tax and an income tax.
Yes, I do.
And you don't have to pay the income tax, but you have to pay the excise tax unless you meet the exception. So every state's a little bit weird. Let's see. So someone's asking, I own property in Indiana and live in California. Do I have to file a state income tax return? In California, you definitely do. I don't believe you do in Indiana. But again, that's what you have real estate professionals. Jeff may want you to file income taxes. Again, I can't see how you would on a rental property.
Sometimes I like doing it just to capture the losses. So if you ever sell the property, you have deductions against your any potential gains.
I
can
see that. You, chances are if you have rental real estate, you're not having income tax because you're going to be offsetting it. And if you don't, then we need to chat because if you're paying tax on it, then you're probably not taking all the deductions you're entitled to. Now everybody's asking, what about Colorado? What about all these others? I can just say that. Like a baseball player who's actively coming in and actively making money, that's different. They're going to be filing tax returns in every state because it's so much money that they're making and they make them do that based off of how many games they play. But if you're just doing passive activities, it's going to flow back to where you live for the most part. You pay your income taxes in the state where you reside for the most part. And then there might be franchise taxes and other things that you have to worry about in a state. Colorado, I'm not aware of. I don't own any property in Colorado.
And you got to remember, you're never going to pay taxes in both your home state and the rental state or wherever you're generating the other income.
Unless it's a franchise tax and you happen to be in California, in
which
case, then all bets are off.
But you usually get a credit from in your home state or...
You get a credit in California because they're going to say $800 minimum.
Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah, they're evil. In case you were wondering... The franchise tax board is a bunch of vampires who are just sucking money out of everybody.
They're not evil. They're just broke.
Well, okay. I shouldn't say the franchise. Okay. The Board of Equalization in California is not evil. They're great people, but they're very aggressive in their collections. They're trying to be nice about it. Tax-wise, hey, if you guys want to come and join, been offering this for the last 2 months, keep offering it all throughout the year, which is if you like tax strategies, some of you guys, looks like you could probably use some. Well, based off the questions, like I always get these, like you should see the questions we get, by the way. We have like a list. I'm looking at the list and just where we're at right now is 456 this year of detailed questions. Like there's a lot of questions that come flying in here. And some of them are like, oh my God. You know, like I think that they went to the anti-tax person, like somebody who really thinks that the country needs a lot of extra money because they're like, here, structure it this way. You can pay twice as much. Yeah, don't do that. So the tax-wise course, June 13th and 14th, then is the next live one. You can live stream it. You can come. You get all the recordings for all three that we did this year. We already did one of them, so you get the recording of that one. Then you'd live stream June and November and get those recordings at all. We make it real easy. It's $197, all freight included for live stream and replay access. Go to AndersonAdvisors.com, tax-wise-2019-3-in-1 offer or 3-in-1 offer, whatever it says on the screen. I don't know who makes these things.
I was going to say, I think they make these names specifically.
I think it's usually a tech guy coming up with a name, not realizing that somebody actually has to type it in.
I'm surprised there's no symbols in there.
Yeah, we make it. It looks like my password. So I don't be, somebody says, be nice. I'm ornery today. All right. So $197. Come join us. I do about 30 different tax strategies, including real estate professional status, plus using that in conjunction with cost segregation. And hey, let's lump in some solar credits while we're at it and accelerated depreciation on the solar. Yeah, we're going to have some fun. If you bought the January 2019, Jim, email us in because we will get you a good deal. All right. Replay should be in your Platinum portal or we'll send out a link. If you want to be a Platinum member, Anderson Advisors. If you don't know what Platinum is, it just means you can ask questions of the attorneys. You get 2 free tickets to any one event. You get unlimited attorney strategy sessions and you can ask questions of the tax team. No cost except for your $35 a month. And there's a sign-up fee unless you did some sort of structure with us, in which case we do all sorts of fun deals to make this thing almost free for you. But if you're a Platinum member, the way I always look at it, it's $35 a month and we're at your beck and call because you want to ask us questions before you do something so we can make sure you do the right thing. It's hard to undo it. All right. Questions. You're thinking, oh, shoot, I have tons of questions, Toby. You can always send them in taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. If you get that, oh, shoot, I forgot to ask, you can ask now. I'm going to go through a whole bunch of questions. You could visit Anderson Advisors and just spend time with us on our site. If you know Clint, Michael, and I, we love to record ourselves. We love to record lots and lots of stuff. And you can spend tons of time watching videos for free. We have a very good YouTube channel and it's tons of fun. And then of course you could go to the podcast. All of these things that I just mentioned are free. Somebody says, what's the fee? It's free. Platinum, it's going to depend. $35 a month. All right. Now we have tons of questions. I'm going to answer a few that were shot out in the very beginning, just because a couple of them I want to make sure that I can see somebody go in the wrong direction here. First off, can a self-directed 401k invest in an opportunity property? So first off, self-directed IRA. That just means you don't have to have a custodian. So whenever I see self-directed, I want to say self-directed IRA because you have to have a custodian, but they allow you to control the investments. You direct the investments in a 401k. You don't have to use a custodian. So I never call them self-directed 401ks. I just call them a 401k because you can be your own administrator, trustee, whatever you want to call it. Can you invest in opportunity property? Yes, but opportunity property, or now assume you're going to be talking about opportunity zones and specifically an opportunity fund, because that's how you get the tax exemption. If you guys don't know about this, the opportunity zones, every state put out a list of zip codes that were approved by the Treasury. All of those zip codes, you could go to opportunity zone, type in heat map, and you'll be able to find a map that you can click on and you can invest in those areas and you could defer capital gains, not just real estate, but any capital gains. I always use Bitcoin as the example. I sell $1 million of Bitcoin. I could defer it for 7 years by investing it in an opportunity zone fund that has 90% of its property in those opportunity zones. Now, the whole idea is to defer your tax. So why would I do that in a 401k or an IRA? The answer is I wouldn't, because there's no reason to do it.
Yeah, there's no tax. You're not going to pay any tax on that capital gain that you're putting in this opportunity zone.
Mm-hmm. Now, and here's the big reason. In an opportunity zone, if you hold that property for 10 years, you have exclusion of capital gains on any of that growth. If I buy $1 million of opportunities fund, if I defer $1 million, I will pay tax on that $1 million. I don't pay tax, by the way, on the full amount. I only pay tax on, as of right now, you'd be paying tax on 85% of it. So I'd pay tax on $850,000 at whatever it would have been. If it was long-term gains, it's still long-term gains. But if that $1 million turns into $10 million in 20 years, you pay zero tax. If I put that same $10 million through my 401k, I have to pay tax with required minimum distributions. And all of a sudden, I took something that would not have been taxable and I made it into something that is taxed at my ordinary bracket and makes my Social Security taxable too. So I would say that's a really bad move and I wouldn't do it. Sorry.
Yeah. And I've seen this happen in the past with people putting municipal bonds and things like that in their 401ks and IRAs. And there's absolutely no reason. It's a lower return.
Yep.
No tax benefit.
Zero tax. Like you just put it in an exempt entity. But what we know is that the entity doesn't pay tax, but you pay tax when you receive it, unless it's a Roth or something, in which case, again, why would you do that?
Roth, there is no tax.
There's no tax on it. And you pay no tax coming out. Why don't I just own it in my where I'm not paying tax anyway? Why do I complicate it by sticking it in there? And then why do I take something that would have been taxable and convert it into something that is simply because somebody told me you should invest through a 401k? That stuff, as soon as I see that, I know somebody's out there pitching it and it bugs the crud out of me. I'm like, you're just taking something that would have been a really good thing for you and you're making a mess out of it. All right. How do I know if I'm a platinum member? You just have to ask us, Phyllis. Just email on in and we'll tell you. You should know because you'd have a platinum portal and you know, we'd invite you and we'd call you and we'd bug you and all that fun stuff. More fun ones here. Let's see. Somebody else asked a really good. All right. We have a management C Corp, manages real estate LLCs. Can we set up a 401k in the C Corp for one of the shareholders that will no longer have a W-2 job without providing one for the other shareholders? If the salary is about $20,000, can they contribute 100% to the plan or only a small percentage? So Todd, that's a great question. And here's the deal. We have to look at how many employees you have. You can do a solo if it's the shareholders. Basically, it's partners. It's and a husband, a wife, and others. So I believe you can do a solo unless you know anything differently. It's shareholders, so they're actual owners in the company.
Well, something I was going to ask is, can we, just because you're a shareholder doesn't make you an employee?
Correct. You have to be a full-time employee still, or in order to be required to be a part of it. And if let's just use this example, they don't have another job, $20,000. I could defer the first $19,000 if I'm under 50, the first $24,000 if I am over 50 directly into the plan, period. No percentages, no nothing. In addition, the company can contribute 25% of the amount. So let's say it paid me, your salary is going to be $20,000. Out of that amount, I could put $19,000 plus another five. So I could put $24,000. This is going to sound weird, but I could put $24,000 into the plan, even though I'd have to probably, well, no, the company can match. So
yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I could put it, I basically, you can get the whole thing in there.
But this is kind of where it's important to determine who's an employee and who's not. Because if you're going to make a company contribution, you may find yourself subjected to having to contribute to other employees.
Yep. All right. Can you tell me what platinum level means? It's just a service. And it's we have two main services here at Anderson that we use funky names for, platinum and titanium. Platinum is our $35 a month. You can ask any question, get on our calendars, and then you can ask tax questions in writing. The reason we want tax questions in writing is because we are going to give you a written response. I don't expect you to remember everything, but I'm going to cite and I'll usually put in something. And the reason I do that is because guess what? People ask the same question every year right at the end of the year. And this way I can just write it once. Say, look at what I said last year. I just signed up for Platinum in a Corp. What's the difference in PPT and Private Vault? Do you know what PPT is?
PPT?
That's PowerPoint to me.
That's what I was going to say.
I have no idea. Private Vault is what we use is Index Universal Life or non-qualified retirement plans or whole life. They're fantastic. It's using code 26 USC 7702 and not paying tax on growth, and you can borrow it out. The private pension is what they might be thinking of.
Personal property trust.
Yeah, I have no idea. Beth, write in what that PPT, what that means. All right. How do you go about transferring a personal home that is to be converted to a rental to an S Corp to increase its basis? If the S Corp has no income, you'd have to give it money first off. And then you'd carry it on installment note. And that's the next question is, would you sell it on an installment note due when the property is sold? And would it be okay to get interest payment in the meantime? Yes. Why would an S Corp be better than a single member LLC? Because an S Corp is a separate tax entity. It is allowed to enter into that transaction. A disregarded LLC is you. A single member LLC is ignored for tax purposes. So you can't sell yourself a house. So you have to use a separate person. All right. Is the California minimum franchise tax the same as the 1.5% for an S Corp or 8.75 on profit C Corp? Yes, the minimum is 800. It's the minimum. So so the question is, do I have to add 800 to whatever that tax is? No, the 800 is just the minimum. It's going to be the higher of. So that's why people always get hit with that 800 because they're like, oh, I don't have any taxable income. I don't need to pay a franchise tax. Nope, that's not how it works. I received a 1099-C, and Jeff, I am hobarting the heck out of this.
No, you're good. You're good.
I'm just like up against the screen. You guys can't see this. It's kind of a small little writing here, and I'm like squinting at it. Here, I'll let you do this one.
I received a 1099-C from a credit card company.
That's a cancellation of debt.
Yes, it is. We protested the rate that they were charging, and they rebated the interest overcharge.
Wow.
And sent a 1099-C for the amount. So the 1099-C, I'll just stop right here, is usually issued for the amount of debt that they write off.
Mm-hmm.
They may say you owe $10,000 and you pay $4,000 to settle the debt. You're going to get a 1099-C for $6,000. How do I deal with this 1099-C without paying the income tax on this amount that was not a benefit and not received or deducted? IRS is probably going to say for interest, you were charged interest for your credit card, and that's going to be part of the debt that you did not repay.
Mm-hmm. They were probably recognizing that income under the accrual basis. So they probably took income and now they're taking a deduction against it. And so they're going to give that to you and say, ha ha. How do you avoid it? You can test the 1099 and say, hey, you didn't actually give me anything. You just didn't charge me something.
There is a possibility if you think that it's a different amount, you can contest that on your tax return. There's actually a form to fill out that says that you disagree with a information form that you were given by somebody.
Well, isn't there a 1099A also? So you have a 1099C, yep, which is cancellation, and 1099A. It used to always be which one triggered the tax.
Both of them can. The 1099A is usually for short sales and things of that nature.
And that's when it's been sold? Let me just see.
Yes.
What does the A stand for again?
A.
There's something.
I want to say acquisition, but I'm not sure that's correct.
No, it's when they actually abandon. There we go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right. So now I remember. You abandoned it. They used to give you a 1099A, and then the question whether that was taxable. The IRS didn't know the answer. And then C is when they cancel it. So somehow, some way, they're saying that they gave you money, and so you might be thinking it's interest, and they may be saying it's principal forgiveness. In which case, now you still owe them the interest, and they're writing down the amount of debt. So you said they rebated interest. They may be treating it as though they extinguished some of the principal. Then it would be taxable to you. So it sounds like you guys are on different pages. So I would definitely be looking at fighting that one, depending on how much it is.
If you are a real estate investor, trader, or business owner who wants to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and build future wealth, then you need to attend the next 3-day tax and asset protection event sponsored by Anderson Business Advisors. At the event, podcast hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman will discuss the art of building generational wealth, ninja equity stripping strategies to discourage lawsuits, the reason to forget LLCs for real estate, tax strategies to stay out of the IRS crosshairs, avoid the joint venture chamber of horrors, and much more. The Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection event is held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Join us for the next 3-day tax and asset protection event and network with other investors and business owners while learning strategies to build your wealth and help you sleep better at night with a solid peace of mind knowing you have prepared for anything. Learn about the next event dates and locations by going to AndersonAP.com and register today. That's AndersonAP.com to register. AndersonAP.com.
Hello, we set up corporations as managers of our rentals to offset our management income. We reimburse healthcare and home use. However, we were unable to reimburse our healthcare in 2019. Are there other similar simple expenses because of the ACA, participating in ACA? I have no idea. Are there other similar expenses, items that we can implement to offset income? That is like a broad question. And yes, there are. There's tons. We go over them all the time here, but what I would do is I'd point you to TaxWise because we're going to go over all of those there, and I would spend some time there. You can just hang out on the Tax Tuesdays. You're going to hear about a whole bunch of them, but everything from cell phone to cars to computers to, you know, that obviously you're using a percentage of your home office. You also do 280A, the corporate meetings. Maybe you're not doing the total home office, which is a percentage. So anything. What documents need to be filed for a C-Corp? Lawrence, it depends on whether you're filing it with the state. If you're filing it with the state, there's always three areas that you need to be aware of: the state itself, third parties like banks, and the federal government. So when you file a C-Corp, you could file it with one, but then you need bylaws for the banks, you need resolutions for the banks, minutes for the banks, some sort of shareholder agreement for the banks. You need to have documentation that gives your C-Corp a body. And then you also have to file an SS4 with the IRS, with the feds. And then you have to also, I'm thinking of states because I'm thinking of the, you may have to register with your state from a taxing authority standpoint.
Yeah.
So all of those things. And then what do you file on an annual basis? If it's a C-Corp, you file an 1120 with the federal, and then you file in whatever states you're doing business in. Number one, here's another question. How can I shield money in an account from a future audit? How can I have an account to shield from taxes? That's interesting. You want to knock that one? I love it when they say, I want to put money aside from a future audit.
I don't even know what to do with the, how can I have money in an account to shield from taxes?
Well, here's a hint. The feds are reaching all over the world right now. They are reaching outside of the United States to get money. And usually what they do is they squeeze the in-country entity and beat up on them. So if you weren't familiar with like what was going on with the Swiss accounts and all that, it's really tough. So,
and if it's a U.S. account, IRS already knows about it.
Yep.
I was registering with something with IRS today, and one of the questions was I had to give them one of my account numbers from a credit card.
Yep.
And they knew what it was.
Yep. They know all about you, unfortunately, or fortunately. They make sure that people pay their fair share. And it's just a question of fair. Now, for protecting yourself from audit, just make sure you're doing business in entities that are low audit risk and have lots and lots and lots of opportunities for deductions. Because the chances are is that if you are audited, if you're an individual, you lose 95% of the time. If you're a business, you win like 700 times more. So way better.
Well, let me ask one thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
I know most times qualified retirement plan accounts are shielded from creditors, correct?
Quite often. It's a creature of state law, and then you also have federal bankruptcy protection. And what a lot of you guys don't realize is that even your taxes, you can bankrupt away taxes.
But IRS, does IRS have access to the QRP funds, the qualified retirement plan funds, or?
Yeah, IRS will grab anything they feel like. Yeah. The IRS, usually if you've done something funky, they'll garnish anything that they can get their hands on. I always say when it comes to the feds, all bets are off. They will go and grab everything. They'll grab your parents' stuff. I've seen them come through and just like, you haven't been paying attention. They will just go and nuke you. Sorry, but that's just the reality of it. So the feds, you don't never want to sit there and, you know, hit them in the head with something. You want to do what's by the rules, and they are very rule driven and they're easy to deal with so long as you follow the rules. You go sideways for those rules, then don't expect them to treat you real nice. All right. So you shouldn't fear, by the way, the IRS or any organization like that. You should respect them, and then you should do things legally. All right. Do you have to have a real estate license to be considered a real estate professional? The answer is no. If I am showing a loss on my tax return for my C-Corp, can I claim that loss on my personal tax return? The answer is no, with the exception of if you dissolve the C-Corp and you made a 1244 stock election. We do that on all of our companies. So if you have a C-Corp set up through Anderson, you could write off up to $50,000 per shareholder of any of the corporate losses. What is a good IRA platform to use? Lowest fees. We like IRA Club. Dennis, really nice guy out of Chicago. IRA Club again. Is partnership income in an IRA required to be income taxed? No. So if you have an IRA owning a partnership, then it would not pay tax on that income.
Correct.
Subject to, there's a few exceptions depending on whether it qualifies as UBIT or if there's debt, in which case, if there's debt on the asset, then it's called unrelated debt finance income and there could be tax on that. But as a general course, no. What are advantage of self-employed trader status? Oh my God, haven't heard that one in a while. So self-employed trader status is, there's no such thing as that. There's trader status. And that is when you meet the test, which is not even a test in a statute. It's a court test of me being a trader. And it's really, really like you need to be doing hundreds of trades. I think the minimum amount that I would even consider is about 700 trades a year, round trip trades, meaning it's probably closer to 1400.
Unfortunately, this is one of those subjective tests.
It's a court test. And I always tell people avoid it like the plague. Trade through either a corporation or a partnership and have a corporation manage it. Do not try to be a trader unless you are really active. Like it's what you do. If you have a job, don't even pretend. What is material participation? How would you document this? We already answered that. Do you lose the long-term capital gains being a... That must be the real estate professional. No, you still have capital gains or capital gains. You don't lose that being a... real estate professional. It's just the losses are not considered passive. Somebody already asked, this is a real estate. I don't know what that means. I have an LLC organized as a single member entity and treated as a disregarded entity. If my wife and I obtain a loan for real estate that is held in the LLC, is it still a disregarded entity? We live in a community property state. The answer is yes. the IRS defaults to your state. And if you're organized as a single member and it's both you and your spouse in a community property, then you're considered one person. Now, this someone says, what about properties in multiple states? They must be asking about income taxes on the income. So if you're a lender and you loan money out to a bunch of people in different states, would you have to file a tax return in each state? I'd say, again, it's interest. Yeah. It's interest income, and it's going to depend.
Oh, if you loan out money, no, definitely not.
Yeah.
Because you're actually performing your service in your home state.
Yep. You are in your home state. They may be someplace else. Do the kids pay FICA taxes? No. Yes and no. If it's payroll, then yes. They're paying old age, death, and survivors and Medicare. So, yeah, they would have payroll taxes.
They're not going to pay unemployment taxes.
They're not. Yeah. The only way around the FICA is if you are a sole proprietor and you employ your kids. That's the only exception. And I would just say, don't be a sole proprietor, because it's so easy for them to say that wasn't really a business activity. Look at this. Do I have to file state tax returns if you have rental loss in New York and New Jersey? So you guys have done these.
Sometimes those states hunt you down.
Mm-hmm.
They know you're there and they want their tax returns.
Yep. Sometimes. If you have a loss, then I doubt it. But again, they don't have a minor.
Yeah, if you have a loss, you're not required to file a tax return.
Yep. And then we may do it just as a matter of course. If we're doing your return, we may do it just because we want to let them know there's a loss. There's a carry forward loss.
Yeah. What most of the states say that if you have any income as a non-resident in their state, you're required to file a return.
Yep.
But if you don't have any income, you've got nothing but losses. There's no requirement to file those returns.
Yep. Jeff may still make you just because he wants to show the loss.
Just because I'm an angry old accountant.
All right. So can you explain the recaptured depreciation, how it is determined? Yeah, it's real easy, Lee. When you buy a piece of property, and I'm just going to say this is probably going to be for real estate, although it works on any business property. If you end up converting business property to personal property, like a car or something, yeah, you're going to have to recapture that depreciation at your ordinary bracket. If it's real estate, then when you sell, you recapture the depreciation, and it's taxed at your ordinary tax bracket, capped at 25%. So if your ordinary tax bracket is 15% or something, actually, what are they now? It's like 14. Is it 15 still, or is it?
No, you got me. I want to say it's still 15.
All right. So then you'd be capped. It would be the 15. But if you're at 37% personal tax bracket, it would be 25%. What is the website for Opportunity Zone again? You just type in Opportunity Zone heat map, and you'll see a bunch.
Google search.
I am interested in a tax-efficient 401k strategy. Clint Coons want to double your real estate investment return as easy as Stacy. I'm gonna have to look that up and see which Clint's my partner. Great guy, very, very, very bright. So what he may be doing is borrowing from the 401k. But I want to see which one that is. I don't have time to watch it right now. Let's see. All right. Question, this would seem to be disqualified. All right, so do you still do these? We're going to have to answer. There's somebody who's referring to a question earlier. And what you do is, if you have a serious question about something that specifically relates to you, email it in via text, tuesday@andersonadvisors.com. I'm not going to be able to answer it quickly here, just because there's like we have people sending in 3 and 4 emails in us because they've run out of room. I have a rental property that I've owned for 9 years. I lived there the first 4 years in one of the units, but the last 5 years I didn't live there. Is there a way that I can avoid the exemption of $500,000? Avoid it. You can't have it, so you wouldn't worry about that. If you haven't lived in there, it's two out of the last five. Yeah, two out of the last five.
So yes, he has avoided the $500 exclusion.
I think they wanted to find it, so maybe they meant how to get it. The answer is no, but you can still 1031 exchange, and that's really important. Dovetail off the question about 401k contributions. If the income the shareholders derive is from the rental property cash flow, can we contribute the max for a year to the solo 401k and not pay taxes? We get 1099s from our property management team. So the answer is they're getting 1099 and they want to be able to put money into a 401k. So if you are the manager, then yes, you can contribute that to a solo 401k. If you are not the manager, and what they're doing is they're giving you the 1099 saying, here's what we paid you, that is not active income. That's not the type of income that you can put into a 401k. What you do is you have that get paid to an LLC that is taxed as a partnership. And you have the corporation act as the manager to that. And then whenever you're doing anything that is management, you do it through your C-Corp, and your C-Corp charges for that activity with your property LLC. And it could, and then yes, you could pay yourself. It sounds weird, but you take money from an LLC. Usually we're using a holding entity. So you have, let's say we have a bunch of rental properties. End of the year, we have $50,000 of positive rents that's not being offset with depreciation or whatnot. I'm charging, you know, let's just say I'm charging $2,000 a month to manage the whole thing. So I have $24,000 deduction against the 50. And then that $24,000, I pay myself a salary. I could put directly into my solo 401k, you know, $19,000 of it, plus make another contribution from the company. So that's kind of how you do it. Do you do estate plans? Yes. Almost always a living trust, unless you like beat us over the head just because there's no reason not to. Here's somebody, I'm wholesaling in Tampa Bay. What is the best structure for protection and tax-wise for holding? I have a two-member Florida LLC. I want to hold properties. Okay, that's different. I'm wholesaling. That's an active activity. I would do that through a corporation or an LLC taxed as a corporation. If you have a, if you're holding properties for long-term appreciation and rental, then you do that through a separate LLC. Depending on how many properties you have, our recommendation is to put each property in its own LLC. So if you have a liability occurrence on one, they can't take.
Yeah, I really like to keep the wholesaling and the investing separate.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't try to group them as the same kind of transactions. And
mm-hmm. Lee asks, can a shareholder of a holding company rent a property owned by the holding company? The answer is yes, unless it is a IRA or 401k that is the owner. If you are a shareholder, though, of a company, you can actually self-deal as long as it is arm's length, meaning that you charge a reasonable amount of rent and all that fun stuff. There's actually lots of cases on that. All right. People like to ask really generic questions. What are the main tax advantages of a C-Corp? Has its own tax bracket. It's a flat 21%. If it makes $1 million, it's 21%. If it makes $10 million, it's 21%. If it makes $100 million, it's 21%. If it pays you that money as profit, just because you get a wild hair and you really want to pay yourself some profit, you pay that at your long-term capital gain trade, which can be as low as zero and as high as 20. In addition, C-Corps can have medical reimbursement plans where they reimburse 100% of medical, dental, and vision, and you do not have to pay tax on it. You just have to be aware of discrimination rules. Those are the big ones on C-Corps. They're a separate tax bracket, and they have fringe benefits that are not taxable to you that are not available through others, not to S's, at least not to partnerships, and definitely not to sole proprietors. See, what is 1099A dividends? There's no such thing as 1099A dividends. You have, 199A dividends. Oh. What they're thinking of is the qualified business income flowing through to you, and it's a 20% deduction. So go ahead.
The REIT, do you say REIT or REIT? Or?
A REIT. The real estate dividends, trust.
Those are also included as 199A.
Yeah, so it has to be qualified business income. And you look underneath that definition, it's active. A certain passive activities qualify, like certain rental activities do. So for example, commercial rentals that are not triple net leases, you spending time and your agent spending 200 hours a year or more on residential property makes that residential property automatically qualify, or you actively being involved in your real estate makes that activity qualify. Sounds weird, but that's the type of, we have regs on this stuff and that's what they're giving us. If you are doing triple net leases, it wouldn't. If you're doing a REIT, the qualified dividends do qualify. If you're doing other corporations where there's dividends, they do not qualify, like an ordinary dividend out of a C-Corp. And then it has to be you, and it can't be a C-Corp. It has to be you. So S-Corp's flowing through to you. Usually you get to write off the 20%. There are some income thresholds, and then they have something called a specified activity, doctoring, architecture, lawyering, medical, veterinarian, engineer, performing arts. All these things are exceptions where they phase you out. And then if you're making too much money, then they look at your W-2 income from the company, not yours, but the company's W-2 total payout, and they put a cap on that. So there's all sorts of funky rules. I've done a ton of stuff on this, both online, and then also there's a big section in TaxWise. So if you really want to know, what I would do is I'd get TaxWise. I think I threw that up there earlier. I'll do it again. It's $197. Do that, and there's a big section on 199A.
I'm just thinking the REITs must have some really good lobbyists if they got that plugged in there.
Oh, REITs. gosh, those guys killing it. And they have carried interest for its long-term capital gains. I have a home office and a basement. Is that basement going to be deducted? You are, well, here's the thing. If you are a sole proprietor, then yeah, you can do that home office. I would prefer you have an accountable plan and reimburse yourself. And then it's going to be the square footage based off of the total square footage or the room methodology or any number of reasonable ways to determine how much of the house you're actually using. And if that's the case, then yeah, you can reimburse yourself, not just the actual space, but your portion of depreciation of the actual house, the depreciation you get to take, the percentage of maintenance, you get to take the percentage of utilities, you get to take, even if you have a house cleaner, you get to take that percentage and reimburse yourself that out of your company. It has to be an S or C corp and you would not be taxed on it and the company can deduct it. We talk a lot about accountable plans here. Here's one that's, speaking of it, I have an accountable plan. Business ran out of cash and has been paying bills personally without reimbursement. Does the amount due to me A, convert to shareholder loan at some point?
Yeah, if the company owes you money, it's a shareholder loan. Or if you're paying bills for the company.
It's kind of like an IOU, but you want, because it, chances are your company's a tax basis taxpayer. So you want it to have the deduction. It needs to pay you back, but it can't, right? So,
right.
So you're literally loaning it so it can, yeah, you're really not paying the bills on its behalf. You're loaning the money to it so it can pay the bills and it could pay you that money back and you do not have to pay tax on that. Hope that makes that sense. Lots and lots of questions, but we have a whole bunch of others over here. I was told today that my C Corp can't deduct a director's gym membership, but can deduct medical insurance, even though the authorizations, resolutions are literally duplicates of each other. Correct. You want to answer that?
Well, the gym membership is not a medical necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes under what we call the wellness plan. This is saying like your vitamins, your over-the-counter medications, the corporation can pay for this. They can pay for your gym memberships, your yoga, your massage. They can pay for it. They can reimburse you for those items, but they can't deduct those items.
Wouldn't you be taxed on it if it was like a C Corp and paid for your gym membership? Sounds like a non-deductible.
No, under the wellness program, you can deduct them. I mean, I'm sorry, I did not say that. You can reimburse for those kind of things.
I'm going to replay that over and over again. No, I'm just kidding.
You can reimburse for those items,
but you can't
the corporation can't deduct them.
And just keep in mind that if it's a C Corp, it's 21%. So you can't, it's reimbursing you, it's not taxable to you. Corporation can't deduct it. It's like meals and meals. You know, you always want to say meals and entertainment. Entertainment is gone as of 2018. But meals, it might only get to write off 50%. So it's kind of weird. You could have a company that has zero money in it and you still have a tax liability, but it's a much less tax liability than your tax liability. So it always trips people out because they're like, well, I spent all the money. Yeah, but the IRS doesn't let you write it all off. So.
Right.
I and my wife file on same tax return. My wife doesn't work. She stays at home. And I have some W-2 plus rental properties. Can my wife sign up for a Roth IRA or IRA to get tax benefit? So how much? So she doesn't make any earned income. Can she have an IRA?
Yep.
Can she contribute? How much can she?
I can't always remember these numbers, but she can contribute to an IRA and I believe a Roth IRA as a stay-at-home spouse.
That's the exception to the rule. Normally it has to be income. So, but if it's a spouse, they can actually do it.
Yes, as long as the other spouse has earned income.
See, there you go. That's why Jeff is worth his weight in gold.
That's a lot of gold.
Yeah, no, I always look at it. You got to have active income, but I think you're right with the, there's an exception.
There is an exception for non-working spouses.
Second, is there a way to offset long-term capital gains for stock? Can I put it in a trust and take it out slowly? Will this work? The answer is pretty much, yes, you could. There's a way to do it. It's called a deferred sales trust. But unless this is millions of dollars, I wouldn't touch that. I would just take the long-term capital gains and recognize it as I sell my stock. If you don't want to pay tax on it, then the only option for you is to put it into a qualified opportunity zone fund or be looking at other ways of getting tax relief.
Another way to offset these long-term capital gains is sell some of your losers.
Yep. Lose money in stock. No, that's what you... No, yeah. So if you have losses on other companies, you're taking them.
If you got a bad deal, go ahead and sell that puppy and you offset it against your long-term capital gains.
Yep. And if you have loss carry forward, take a look too.
Yes.
So you don't lose them. Just carry them forward. This is a very long question. I'm going to skip it. I have self-storage business in Virginia. I'm looking to expand and purchase another facility in Tennessee. What is the ideal structure I should use for this business and real estate investing? That's a very broad question, but the answer is for most self-storage units, they're going to be in an LLC in the state where they're located. Since you have two, then what I look at is it might be time to separate yourself from your businesses by having the businesses and LLCs and then put a holding company in another state that's not near you so that in the event somebody ever attacked one of those businesses that they don't get to come after you. Now, the Tennessee puts us in a little bit of an interesting position since it's has a franchise tax, the FONS, and we want to avoid that. In that particular case, for what you're doing right now, I'd probably just have two LLCs, one in Virginia, one in Tennessee, and I'd have you, if it's just you, then you would be the owner. And I may look at adding a holding company at some point.
But you would definitely split them between two LLCs.
I would definitely. In fact, if you have any debt, they're not going to let you put those two together. They don't like banks, believe it or not, do not like foreclosures. I am presently funding gap funding through my S corporation, a number of residential flips, all of which are expected to resell later this year. Assuming 6 months or more holding periods, is my income in these deals taxed as long-term capital gains? That sounds like she is the gap funder. So if they're a gap funder through an S corp, then they're going to just receive that as interest. That's going to be ordinary income. It would not be long-term capital gains.
And this is where I feel it's important how these agreements are written to say what you're receiving in return.
Yep. And this is really big, by the way. Whenever you are flipping, and this sounds like you're just funding the flip, but if you're the flipper, it doesn't matter how long you hold it. So we have a little bit of an issue there because if you are flipping, then there's no such thing as long-term capital gains. It's all going to be ordinary income. Does a new LLC who had to borrow funds have to file a promissory note in order for the note to be enforceable or legal? No, that's real easy. It sounds like you borrowed the money. And if I was the party that gave you money, I'd want to make sure that's documented. But if they did give you the money, does it need to be in writing for them to be able to enforce it? No, it certainly helps. And they may have issues collecting against you, but they could show that you actually gave the money, then they're going to have various opportunities to come back. Pay your debts. Background, I recently entered the real estate business, 5 properties, 16 units, and learning all the real estate language. Should I purchase additional insurance coverage or establish LLC for each of my properties? The answer is yes to both of those. You want to make sure that you have your regular insurance and you want to have a umbrella insurance as well. I call it lawsuit insurance in case they exceed the primary. And yeah, you separate an LLC, you put each of the properties in its own LLC. Should I establish an S-Corp and have the S-Corp own each of the LLCs? No, not unless you are flipping. The S-Corp is used for active real estate, so real estate agent, flipping, somebody who is wholesaling, and then what would be the best option, an LLC or an S-Corp? An LLC can be an S-Corp for tax purposes, files with the state as an LLC. So realistically, what you're really asking, I think, is do we want to have an LLC taxed as a partnership or disregarded or an S-Corp? Well, if you're holding these things, it looks like 5 properties, 16 units. You're going to hold these for a while. You're always going to be better off having it flow onto your personal return on your Schedule E. That's going to be done via an LLC that's disregarded or an LLC taxed as a partnership. When setting up your initial 501c3, where should the startup funds come from? Your personal account or as a loan? Or is the startup considered a donation? That one. There we go. So Jason, the answer is when you put money in startup a 501c3, it's considered a contribution, a donation. So could you loan it the money? Yeah, but I guess somebody possibly could do that. I wouldn't. I would just call it a contribution. And even if you loan the money, by the way, this I forgot about this. If you loan money to a nonprofit, it's considered a contribution and then it's income to you when they pay you back. The IRS doesn't play around. They said if you're loaning money to a 501c3, that's a contribution. You just gave them the money. And if they pay you back, then it's income to you. We own an S-Corp, LLC, and a C-Corp. We work out of our house. We do not deduct our office space on our taxes. We are going to remove the septic system and hook it into a city sewer, which means there will be several days where we have cannot wash. I'll just leave it at that. We would like to check into a hotel. Can we deduct the hotel expense as business expense? The answer is no.
Yeah, this is cost of giving up your home.
Right. What you would do is you want to have the office space. And then what would happen is the company could reimburse you for all of its percentage of the cost. So usually you get a business, you're going to be somewhere between 10% and 20% of a house, sometimes higher, depending on you know, how big your house is, how many rooms it has, how big a spot your business is occupying. But what you would end up doing is reimbursing the cost, the percentage of the septic system. The hotel expense, no, it would not be considered a home expense. Well, possibly, I guess you could try to lump it in there and say that it's...
It kind of goes along with the business continuity insurance way of thinking.
Yeah. I mean, here's what you would do. You would list it down as all the expenses of the house. I'd throw it in there. And if the IRS ever audited you, you'd have a novel argument. But I could see how you'd work. You'd say, hey, this was our cost to run our household. And you know, let's say it was 15% that the company occupied. They could reimburse you. It's not a line item anywhere. It's just for you. You just get the cash. The company writes it off. And I'd be doing that through your S or C Corp. I have an LLC taxed as a partnership with the members, 40% my wife, 40% me, 40% a corporation, which manages the LLC. All profits gained by the LLC in trading considered to be passed immediately to the members. Yeah, that works. So what happens is if you make $10,000, you and your wife would get $8,000 of it and $2,000 it would go to the corporation, whether or not the money's distributed or not. That's how it'd work.
Right.
Now, you could pay the corporation. If this is, sounds like a part, it's a partnership. You hopefully you have an agreement that says the corporation can get paid to manage the thing because it's going to have expenses too. For example, anything that you're doing, like computers, cell phone, home office, all those things, you'd want to make sure that it gets that money as a guaranteed payment. And then that would lower your total, like you'd take that off the top. So if it made $10,000 and you had expenses of $3,000, you'd end up dividing $7,000. You take the $10,000 minus the $3,000, you divide that 40-40-20 between the partners. Anything you want to add on that, Jeff?
Nope.
Let's see. Formed a single member LLC in 2018. What tax form to report? You don't. It's disregarded. It's you. So you don't have to worry about it. So hopefully if it's a disregarded single member, it depends on the activity. It would go on your 1040. If it's a active business, then it would go on your Schedule C. If it's a passive business, it goes on your Schedule E, right?
Right. The only reason you would file it on 1120 is if you actually designate it with the IRS that this entity is filing as a corporation.
Mm-hmm. Here's somebody else. I am confused on using a Wyoming LLC and it being a disregarded entity. I purchased property using the LLC, which I'm in the process of rehabbing. So first off, don't do that. You are a dealer. You're an active business and it's going to flow right onto your Schedule C, not your E, your C. Where do I get to deduct the cost that I'm incurring for the rehab? You don't. When you flip, it gets added to your basis, period. There's no way to do that to where that's deduct. That's there, actually, I shouldn't say there's no way. There is one way, which is to do it through a 501c3. And, you know, you'd have to, like, let's say that I was rehabbing houses for veterans or single moms or any number of old people, whatever. I shouldn't say old people, elderly. And I qualify my 501c3 in that activity, then I could buy the house in there and I could give it cash to do the rehab. And I'm deducting it as I go. Like whatever I put in cash wise into that thing, I'm writing it off. And then it never pays tax again. Otherwise, if it's in my personal realm, you don't get to do any of that. You are adding that to basis. And then it's basically stocking your store. And then when you sell it, you get that's cost of goods sold. So it's the basis. So you'd only pay tax on the difference, but it would be active ordinary income. So I'm just going to say, don't do that. Talk to us. We need to change the tax of that entity. It should more than likely, we're just going to make an S election on it if that's what it's doing. And it's a Wyoming LLC. Unless you live in Wyoming, chances are we're either setting up a new LLC in your home state or you're registering that Wyoming as doing business in the state where the property is located. Here we go. I am getting $80,000 from a Roth IRA from my divorce. How is it best to reinvest it in my house flipping business? How is best to reinvest it with my house flipping business? If it's in a Roth IRA, you're going to want to leave it in there. Can you flip inside of an IRA? You can. You'd want to set up an LLC owned by the Roth IRA. And then for all you guys who are immediately going UBIT, there's no cases on it. I would say that if you're going to do one or two, you're probably fine. If you're doing six or seven, you're probably going to run into a potential of having unrelated business income tax. But even that's taxed at what, 21% now, UBIT?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So worst case scenario, you're going to pay corporate rate. But best case scenario is you never pay tax ever again on any of those gains. I want that. Look at this. I purchased a commercial office flex building in October 2018. I'm evaluating cost segregation. I would appreciate the following thoughts. As I understand it, there are two gains. With cost segregation, I get the larger tax depreciation in the early years compared to standard property depreciation. This can reduce my taxable income for the early years. If I sell the property 10 years, this early deduction has increased value. This is the first gain. I have no idea what that means. If I use CC, cost segregation, I will have larger capital gain when I sell the property. No, you won't. Here, let me just explain this. Cost segregation, all I'm doing is I'm rapidly depreciating it. That has nothing to do with capital gains because we always take depreciation out of the capital gains equation. So if you're cost segregating,
it's going to decrease its basis by taking more depreciation.
But he's going to have to recapture it, right? When you're calculating,
that's true.
Yeah, you're going to have. So what's going to happen is, even though I'm getting an earlier depreciation, my capital gains is going to be my capital gains. It's going to be my basis. Period. Then I'm going to have depreciation recapture. So I wrote it off earlier. So let's say that I rapidly depreciate something that would have been 39 years. I get an extra $500,000 of deductions in the first 10 years. Like I'm excited. That saved me a bunch of money. I'm going to, if I 1031 exchange that, first off, we don't worry about it at all. It just rolls into the new property. If I don't 1031, but I sell this thing and I pay tax on it, the maximum amount I will pay on that accelerated depreciation, all that extra money is 25%. This is why it's so powerful when you are a real estate professional. You can offset 37% tax in some cases, depending on what state you're in, 51% tax, and I can cap it at 25% federal and then whatever your state is. So it's pretty powerful, but I'm not altering my capital gains out of this. My capital gains is still long-term capital gains. I would be paying it at my long-term capital gains rate, which is 0 to 20%. If I'm making a lot of money, then I have to add the net investment income tax. So it's 0 to 23.9 plus your state. That's why 1031s are so powerful. Yeah, somebody just said, did I hear that right? If I'm flipping a property, say in Illinois, and purchase the property using a Wyoming LLC, that is bad. Yeah, if you are flipping an estate, you should be, I don't even know how you took title in that. I mean, it's possible you did it, but you want to be an S-Corp on that, or an LLC tax as an S-Corp. And frankly, you'd want to register the Wyoming LLC in that state. If you could probably get away with one without registering it there. But yeah, let's see. Somebody just asked a really interesting question. I formed a C-Corp and then I went on this bus tour. They have a lot of expenses. Let's just say that the expenses are $75,000 after the C-Corp was established. And do I list these expenses on a monthly expense report? Yeah, absolutely. And if you paid the cash to it, it owes you that money back. And so that's generally speaking, you're going to take the expense and it's going to, you've loaned it the money and you're going to be able to repay yourself that money. If C Corp needs to make money. So if the C Corp only collects $10,000 this year, can I write the $10,000 as expense reimbursement? Well, you've already paid the expense. So you're just going to pay off the loan of you giving the money to the company. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, you can always repay. What you repay has no tax consequences.
Yeah, it's going to be immaterial from a tax standpoint, but you could just say, hey, you owe me this money, but it was paid somehow, some way it was paid. So I like to think that you probably paid that with cash or a check or something or credit card. So, you know, yeah, it could just reimburse you if it goes over a tax year. So it looks like this was last year, then chances are it's going to be treated as a loan. Wow. I have holdings in my self-directed IRA, real estate in Brazil.
Oh, wow. That's not good.
No. Wow. Due to currency exchange, we lost more than 2/3. How do I adjust the value? You don't. You don't have to do anything, Tim. It's just maybe if you're taking mandatory distributions, you're going to have to do that, but you're just going to, for whatever reporting. So they have that form on an IRA where you have to report the real estate holdings. I guess you'd have to do that, but that is horrible. You'd turn it into U.S. cash.
And I know QRPs, qualified retirement plans, cannot hold foreign properties.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that holds true for IRAs.
They must have a self-directed IRA. They must have a custodian, but it seems like it's weird, but whatever the case, that's really bad. But I don't think you have to do anything. Going back to long-term gains, if we were flipping a property, why would it be different as keeping it 12 months? Well, so capital gains is selling a capital asset. It's not a capital asset when you buy it to sell it. It is inventory. So it's like this. Let's say I'm a grocery store and I buy a whole bunch of Cheerios and put it on my shelf. And that Cheerios doesn't sell for a year. Have I owned it for a year? Yes. When I sell it, do I get long-term capital gains? No, because it's inventory. When I am flipping a house, I am not an investor. I am a dealer. It is inventory. So it doesn't matter how long I held it. In fact, there are cases where people held it over 10 years and they're still treated as an active business. So I'm going to do this one. This is sad. My parents recently passed and my siblings and I each inherited rental property in California. Six siblings, six properties. Since we'll each own one property, would it make sense to form six LLCs and have a holding company in Wyoming, one name? So yeah, so Ellie, here's what you can do. It makes sense to put rental properties in separate entities, but I would say you don't want to have six LLCs in California. What I would more than likely do is have the holding, I would have them in six LLCs, but I would keep them out of the state of California. I'd hold them in trust in California with having it at the out-of-state beneficiaries be the LLCs. And I would have you and your siblings hold a single LLC in which you each own 1/6 interest and it owns the respective LLCs. So, I wouldn't.
So instead of each of them owning their own house.
There are six houses in one LLC, and that way you guys can figure out, you're not worried about, I'm sure they're not all of equal value. So rather than dealing with it, that would be my recommendation off the cuff. So facts and circumstances are already different. Like if your siblings, depending on your relationship. And if you also, some people may want to sell something and may, versus holding it. If you guys all want to hold it and you're just saying, hey, we just want to keep this thing together, then I would probably set up an LLC where you guys all own a piece and you agree to a management mechanism. That's easiest, more than likely. You stepped up in basis, by the way. So make sure that you know that when your parents passed, the basis in those properties stepped up to the fair market value on the day they passed, which means you get to depreciate them again. That's kind of the silver lining is whenever there's someone who passes, the asset steps up in basis and you get to depreciate it, even if they depreciated it their whole life. So anyway, and then somebody just asked, what about asset protection? Yeah, what I do is a couple ways to look at this. When you have an LLC, there's more than one way to get a property in an LLC. I could put it directly in the LLC or I could put it in a trust where the beneficiary is the LLC. So if I don't like the state because they're charging me too much money, I'll oftentimes use a trust. So California, I don't want to have a bunch of LLCs because it's $800 a year per LLC. And if you own the LLC individually, that could be a problem if it's out of state. So I make sure that the LLC is owned, you know, there's one LLC that's potentially doing business in California, and that's the LLC that all six siblings own. And then even then, I don't know where all the six siblings live. What I care about is that we keep it away. And if somebody says, well, no way, the franchise tax board, they're going to kill you on it. We won that audit. So I already know what the answer is. They're going to tell you, you always owe it. Like they're always going to say, pay us, even if you don't have to. So I just kind of look at it and say, I know what the rules are. So I tend to be a little more, let's just keep it away from them. There'll be one entity that we pay the $800 on. It'll be the one that's held by all six kids, assuming that there's children that live in California. So sorry for your loss, by the way. I know it's always tough to lose a parent, but if there's anything that's good, usually gets the kids together and hopefully you treat it as a legacy and you say, hey, my parents worked really hard for this. Let's see, what's the best bookkeeping system for real estate investors and financial services corps? QuickBooks.
We're always going to say QuickBooks.
QuickBooks. Yeah, I mean, you could try other stuff, but that's kind of like, you know, and also ran. That's like, where do you order stuff online? Amazon. And then there's everything else. What is the ordinary income tax bracket for a real estate professional filing together with high W-2 earners making over $1 million? 37% federal plus your state. I know there's a couple more questions. We'll grab those and we'll throw those into the next Tax Tuesday. You do. Somebody asked about the IRAs and stuff. It's like 5,500. They raised it this year. I think it's 5,500 or 6,000.
6,000.
6,000. And then you get an extra $1,000 if you're over 50. So you can put 7?
Yeah.
All right. So, well, we can always look at that. We have a tax cheat sheet rolling around here somewhere. As always, a little bit of tax knowledge goes a long ways. So hopefully you picked up a few tidbits here and there. I know there's probably some people sitting at home red-faced if they were doing something kind of funky. Just know that the tax laws are extremely forgiving if you take action to fix it. Oh, and Sherry says, thank you. And it was great seeing you too. So hi, Sherry. Client had lunch with. It's always fun. Hey, they're always cool. When they come in town, sometimes people reach out and say, let's go have lunch. I'm like, sure, I'll meet anybody anywhere.
I'm always up for lunch.
Yeah, it's always good, eh? Yeah. It's always fun to hang out with people. They're really cool. Sherry, we've gone motorcycle riding. If you guys like Harleys, they're awesome. So they're just a hoot. So they're really good people. So I'll say hi. Hi, Sherry. and Allison and all the cool people that I get to hang out with. That's the benefit of doing tax stuff, guys, is we get to see people all over the country all the time. And we've been doing this so long that it's cool. Like, you guys don't even realize, but there's just for this little webinar, we had over 1,000 people registered on it.
Yep.
So you're in good company. So anyway, so keep learning. Don't get discouraged, even if you have a bad tax mishap. I always look at it as like it's touching a hot stove. Just know, don't touch it again. And don't put your hand on it and say, it's not hot, it's not hot, it's not hot, when your hand's burning. So it's like, let's just use some common sense. And then a little bit goes a long ways. And in this wonderful world, if you're in the realm of entrepreneurship, you should benefit from your activities. The tax laws are written to give you benefit. And the one word that I like to hear more out of clients' mouths or anybody that's in business is, how do I write that off as opposed to can I? The answer is too easy to a no, or it depends. It's much better when you say, how do I write it off? Now we're thinking. And yep. We're going to find a way, and it may not be the way you think, and it may not be the way we think, but it always pushes us. And if you can't tell, we've been doing this a long time. Jeff, how long have you been a CPA?
27 years.
Yep. So I've been 20 some years plus myself, 22 years. Every day we learn something new. So you have, what is that, 49 years? And then we have some, you know, Gary downstairs has been doing it forever. All these guys, Doug downstairs, been doing it 30 something years. Yep. A lot of these guys, you always learn something new. So don't be discouraged. It's not, you know, if it was straightforward, everybody would do it, right? But a little bit of tax knowledge goes a long ways. So we will see you next Tax Tuesday. What, 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
It'll probably be, what, it'll be April. So we'll see you in April. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.